Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Well, it's been a week in which we've sort of paused, I think, as a nation from the federal political scene, and Australia took a deep breath. And wasn't Australia grateful? Even the new Prime Minister-elect, he's sworn in tomorrow, decided to stay well out of the media for the last week. Isn't it odd? The media sort of feeds on this frenzy and builds up a frenzy, then criticises the frenzy, and then it stands back when there's no frenzy left and says, oh, where's the new Prime Minister? What's he doing? Well, maybe he's just getting on with the job. So, almost a politics-free week from the coalition, at least. We've had some to-ing and fro-ing in the Labor Party about their leadership, and that's an interesting contest that's building up. Anthony Albanese and Bill Shorten now hit our airwaves for an internal Labor Party campaign that'll be played out in front of the whole country. That's going to be something different for Australia. But I think, you know, after the last 6 years, and particularly the last three, Australia is looking for a big change. And the man himself who's promising that change is our new Prime Minister, Tony Abbott. Well, a man who's seen it for 40 years, coming and going, and who indeed took time away from the front bench during the last Parliament to be the Parliamentary Secretary to the Shadow Cabinet, and then was with Tony Abbott pretty much every day of the campaign, is known as the Father of the House. His name is Philip Ruddock. And Philip Ruddock, good evening to you.
Evening, Stephen.
Very nice to speak with you.
Pleasure.
Now, Philip, was it Friday that you clocked up 40 years?
No, it's next Saturday.
Next Saturday.
Next Saturday.
You were a very young man when you were first elected.
In Rose Hill Gardens, who at least I would say commemorate, some might say to celebrate.
Just you and about 3,000 of your closest friends.
Oh, maybe 1,000.
And you'll have the new Prime Minister there?
Believe so.
Hmm. What sort of a Prime Minister is Tony Abbott going to be?
Well, extraordinarily conscientious. He is a person who has a capacity to focus very clearly on the issues that he has to deal with. I mean, I sat with him on the plane for 5 weeks during the campaign. I had two nights in my own bed and one night participating in a debate in my own electorate, but I was away for the rest of the time. And I must say, sitting beside him in the plane, watching the way in which he prepared, the professionalism of the support staff he had, his chief of staff, Peter Credlin, Andrew Hirst, who deals with the media issues, watching the way in which he undertook the task, you couldn't help but be impressed with his focus and his readiness to represent Australia and to act in Australia's best interests.
He's capable of a number of modes, is Tony. I mean, people have seen him as an attack dog in the Parliament for quite some time. This year, commentators would say, and I think I probably was one of them, saying that he'd changed his modus operandi because he needed for people to see him in a different light. Now, in the last few days, the very few media appearances he's made, we've seen him in a very, very somber sort of mode, leadership mode. So how are we to know, and he talks about, Philip, about a kindler, gentler polity. People will be asking, well, is the man who was so much on the attack, so sharp in his attack for the last several years, is he going to bring us that kindler, gentler approach?
Well, I think you ask yourself what role are people asked to undertake. Of course, Tony, initially, was the leader of opposition business in the Parliament and the person who represents the government in that role of leader of the House has to be aggressively putting the government's position, and Tony, in that role, aggressively put the opposition's position. I mean, that's something that is expected very much of the people who undertake that role. Christopher Pyne has been doing it in more recent times, and it is the fact that there are a multiplicity of tasks that have to be undertaken, and when you are essentially the lead in relation to the debating positions that you need to take, sometimes it's characterised as being aggressive, but it's you've certainly got to put very strongly your position. And Tony, I think, has been able to do that.
And did he find it difficult, Philip, to work out his equilibrium when facing a female Prime Minister?
No, I think that in terms of facing a female Prime Minister, he's the only leader of the opposition, effectively, who's had to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there seem to be some expectations that if it's a woman in the role, you have to act differently. My view, quite frankly, would be that if a woman aspires to lead, she has to be prepared to meet the same sort of contest that any other leader would have to meet.
What do you mean by that? That she has to be like a man and take it like a man?
If you look at somebody like Margaret Thatcher, I don't think people in the United Kingdom thought that they had to be less prepared to put their arguments forcibly simply because she was in that role. And equally, I think having a woman in the role, I don't think one needs to be gratuitous about these things, but I think you need to put your arguments forcefully and strongly. If you're not prepared to do that, I think your view is less well represented.
How will you remember Julia Gillard?
Well,
you've seen a lot of prime ministers come and go.
I have. I think time will tell. My view is that I think she traded to a degree on the fact that she was a woman, in a way that I think Margaret Thatcher never sought to trade on her gender.
Hmm.
I think there was a degree of that.
I'm really interested to know, Philip, how you think that she did that in a way that wasn't her entitlement as a woman.
I think the speeches in which people were attacked for misogyny, simply because they put a forceful argument, was reflecting a view that as a woman you were entitled perhaps to less scrutiny.
Hmm. My guest tonight is Philip Ruddock. He's the longest-serving member, third longest-serving member ever in the House of Representatives, clocking up 40 years next Saturday. And if you'd like to join our program tonight to talk about any aspect of politics and the sort of parliament that you think we ought to have in this 28th term, call me now, 1300 40 20 20. Philip, there are some difficult issues, and I know you personally, and I know you as a man of compassion, and Australia may or may not remember that you crossed the floor at one time over a very important issue for you, which was the question of equality in the approach that we take to immigration matters, and this a motion that the then opposition had put up to try to trap members on your side of the House over the Asian question. So those days are long gone, but you're a man who stood up for your principles and a man of compassion. So there are two issues that Australians are concerned about, that many Christians have spoken to me about, and I'd be very interested to gauge your view on these as well. The first, obviously, is the asylum seekers question. Do we have a position now where both sides of Parliament are doing something that is, on the face of it, very lacking in compassion?
Well, it is a difficult issue, and let me just take you back.
Hmm.
When I started in public life, the first major issue we faced in relation to refugees were the people who were fleeing Vietnam. And if you recall, those who fled were essentially those who were being identified by the communist regime to be submitted to re-education, and they were being taken off to fairly oppressive sites for that purpose, and people fled.
Mm.
And the initial population that left Vietnam were amongst the former South Vietnamese leadership in public life, in government, in relation to perhaps military roles, those who had been reasonably successful in business,
mm.
And They were people who genuinely fled oppression. When we moved over a period of time to see what happened, a lot of the people who later came were not necessarily affected in the same way. There were people who had no identification with the previous regime. There were people who were, in fact, thought amongst many of the Vietnamese even to have been Viet Cong.
Well, but yes, but the problem now is sorting out the genuine refugees, I suppose, from those who are not genuine. I think people understand that, but nonetheless, you have a policy of offshore processing now.
No, I was going to, I suppose, develop the argument fairly slowly. I spent a lot of time focused on what was happening in Cambodia. I went to the camps in which the Vietnamese were held in places like Phillibodong in Malaysia. I went to Hong Kong, the Whitehead Detention Centre. In the early 80s, I went to Pakistan to see the Afghans. I visited Romanians in Trishkirtan in Europe. I spent an enormous amount of my time in public life focusing on situations in which people had fled, were located, and certainly weren't on boats, I might say, at that point in time, coming to Australia. But I was very focused on those people who were being oppressed, had no prospect of being able to return home, those people who had little prospect of being able to be settled where they are. And as I went on and saw situations of people in Africa, in the Balkans, I became very focused on the fact that Australia was in a unique position to be able to help people who were refugees in positions of vulnerability, in need of a resettlement and a permanent resettlement outcome that took them away from where they were going to continue to experience danger.
So has the debate of the last few years, in which whatever else is happening, it's lent itself to a sense of creating these as other, of almost demonising these most vulnerable people who clearly tug at your heartstrings. Has that debate not troubled you?
I question the argument, the most vulnerable. My view is that those who are free enough to travel and have the money to pay to ensure that they are able to travel are in a very different situation to those who are locked away, seen by nobody, and have no capacity to be able to move. I mean, look, if the situation was that the refugees that we ought to want to help, knowing that we can't help them all, were to be those who were free enough to travel and had the money to be able to engage people to traffic them across borders, would they be the people that you would judge to have the greatest need for help and assistance? And in my judgment, the people I have seen in camps where they suffer significant and continuing vulnerability because of the leadership role that they've often taken, with no prospect of being able to return home.
Right, no, I get what you're saying. So will we see an Abbott government reaching out to those then if they are the most vulnerable?
Well, I think any government should be focused on that, and we've lost the capacity to be able to deal with those questions because the numbers that have been arriving here essentially now take almost all of the places. Look, I went only a few weeks ago, before the election, I might say, to Jordan, and I had the opportunity with Save the Children to see many of the people who have fled from Syria at the moment. You know, and I know, that there is the most horrific civil war occurring right now, and people are being targeted. I met young girls of 13 and 14. In one case, the girl had seen her uncle shot in front of her, her cousin similarly shot. I saw another girl who was a similar age, whose father was a pharmacist from Damascus, who'd had his leg shot off. They had no money left that had been expropriated from them as they fled from what was occurring, and they were living in circumstances in Amman in Jordan, which you can only describe as exceedingly oppressive.
Yes, I've seen some of those
And games. You ask yourself, how can I help? And I can tell you, you know, we are not at the moment taking any people Of which there are now something of the order of 2 million people, I might say, from Jordan, from Turkey, from Lebanon, who are fleeing these events which are occurring right now. And our capacity, when you think about it, I mean, we have had a refugee program of around about between 12 and 20,000 people a year. The United States, which has, 13 times our population, takes about 70,000. There are only about a dozen countries in the world who will, in fact, settle people from the camps around the world. And who do you take? You try to identify who is most vulnerable and in need of assistance, knowing that you can't help all.
Thank you. I think people will be very pleased to hear those words coming from someone so key to the future of the government. What role will you be playing, Philip, that might be able to see you addressing some of those issues from within and perhaps turning around a situation in which, as you say, we're not able to take the most, or even assist the most vulnerable, and foreign aid has been cut, another thing that concerns people. But the question is, now will you be able to work within the new government? What role will you take that might enable you to do that?
Well, I think we'll have to wait and see what role I might take, but Tony's got to make some announcements in the next day or so.
Will you be in his cabinet?
I don't think so, but that's a matter for him.
In other words, did you offer yourself for the cabinet?
I'm available to serve the leader in any way that he thinks appropriate. And I wouldn't put any higher or lower than that. I elected some time ago not to offer to serve on the front bench when people were, we'd been defeated in an election and people were looking again at whether you needed to undertake a new start, I thought the leader should be given an opportunity to do that. Tony invited me back as the Shadow Cabinet Secretary, as you know, and he has sought my counsel and advice from time to time, and I'm flattered that he has, I'm available to share with my colleagues my experience in any way that can be useful.
But you're really saying that we wouldn't be expecting to see you then in a front bench role, and that would be your own choice, in a sense.
I'm simply saying that those choices are matters for the leader, and the leader has to make choices about what he thinks is the way forward over a longer term than perhaps even this election. So in relation to what role I might fulfil, it has been in a what has been described as a mentoring role to share my experience, which is over time judged to be considerable, I've been more than happy to offer whatever counsel and assistance I can.
Very good. Well, Philip, congratulations and thank you for your 40 years of public service, and thank you for being with us tonight.
It's a pleasure. Nice to talk to you, Stephen.
Take care. Philip Ruddock, he was the Secretary to the Shadow Cabinet by his own choice, and I think you'll find also it will work out that he'll choose not to serve, or not to make himself available in a way that will serve on in a front bench capacity within the new government. But I think you'll find nonetheless a very significant role continuing for Philip Ruddock. And what an interesting insight to hear him speak with such passion about things that you don't often hear in the Australian political debate. Maybe if we can get away from this bang, bang, blame you, blame you, blame you, stop the boats, debate, discourse that we've had for 3 years and we're sick of it up to here. Maybe if we can get down to a debate where we can, like Philip, get into those camps in Amman, Jordan, for instance, and think about that young girl who saw her family shot in front of her. If we can, as a nation, try to embrace those things and call on our government to do so, maybe we can make a greater contribution on the world stage than some people have been worried about.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.